Welcome to episode 6 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week we feature interviews with T. Jefferson Parker and Daryl James that Les Klinger and I recorded at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. Technically, this is the last of the series of 4 podcasts recorded at the LA Times Festival of Books, but I have plans for a bonus episode with who I like to call a true thriller writer, Annie Jacobson, who will talk about her New York Times bestseller, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. We plan to publish that in 2 weeks. First up is Jeff Parker. Now that his Charlie Hood series has wrapped after the 6th installment, The Famous and the Dead, Jeff has stepped away from mysteries to write a standalone novel about a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. I think it's interesting how Jeff feels about the characters that he's retired, and he talks about it on the podcast. At least for now, for those who were captured by Charlie, his devilish nemesis, Mike Finnegan, Bradley Cooper, and Aaron McKenna, there's hope. Jeff says that he never says never to bring in a character back. In other words, we may see them again. I'm also fascinated on how authors come to mystery writing. I think it's safe to say that, perhaps with the exception of Megan Abbott, who wrote her PhD dissertation for NYU on noir fiction, no one sets out to be a mystery writer. Jeff Parker came to the craft from the world of journalism. As phenomenal as he is as a mystery writer, and Jeff is a 3-time Edgar Award winner, he still has journalism chops. When I was at the Los Angeles Times Magazine, he wrote a riveting piece on ATF officers and their struggle to control the traffic of guns. I'll post a link to the article on the website. Once again, I'd like to apologize for the ambient noise. We're still getting our techno chops together. First, here's Jeff Parker. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. We're here with T. Jefferson Parker, who just concluded his Charlie Hood series with The Famous and the Dead. Jeff's next book is not a mystery. It's a standalone about a returning Afghanistan vet. But I want to ask him, and Les will jump in as well, I want to ask him what it feels like to end a series, and does he miss Charlie?
Well, yeah, I miss Charlie, and I miss the cast of characters, you know. I mean that series was 6 books long, and I put a lot into it. So by the time you get to the end of that 6th book, it's literally teeming with characters that I think are really interesting.
And spin-offs, I assume. I mean, can't we see some Mike stories?
Maybe I may revisit some of those people later. I don't really know. But I'll tell you, I mean, to answer your question, you know, to bring that series to a close was my decision, and I wanted to. And but it was very difficult to do, and I miss those characters. I remember, you know, the classic, you know, book comes out, book is finished, I'm finished writing the book, and I realized that I'm not going to be writing any of those characters for a while. And I felt a little bit lonely and a little bit, I felt abandoned by them, even though I sort of abandoned them. You know?
Let me ask about that series, Jeff, in particular. I loved it. Let me start by saying that. But it didn't go where I thought it was going to go when in book one. And in book one sort of started out to be another great Jeff Parker cop mystery and all that. And it, of course, it veered toward the, dare I say the word, supernatural.
You can say that.
In part. And did you know that from the beginning?
No. That didn't become apparent until the 3rd of the books, of the 6 books, Iron River. I wanted to embody and give words to a devil. And so Mike Finnegan makes his appearance at the in that book. And
right.
He plays kind
first
of a
chapter.
Small part, but he's an important part of that book. And so when I hatched that series at book one, I had no inkling that Mike would be coming on stage. One of the things I tried to do when I was writing the book was to keep an open mind towards what was interesting to me, and rather than kind of force the series to go where I thought it should go, I tried to stay open to ideas from my characters and what I would run across in life and want to put in there. So
the first
it was, in spite of the fact that it seems like a very premeditated complicated,
your interest.
Sort of, you know, organized six-book series. It's completely pell-mell the way I wrote it. I mean, I tried to make each one better than the last one, but as far as where it was going to go, I couldn't have told you at the beginning of book six what was going to happen in the last book.
Have you heard from any fans that are angry or disappointed that it...
I've had a lot of people say that they wish Charlie was coming back, you know?
Well, that's always...
Which is what you want to hear, you know, definitely. I don't hear a lot of, you know, God, I'm so glad you're getting him off stage.
Well, you didn't kill him, so, you know.
I did not kill him. I did
not kill him. And you also didn't kill Mike Finnegan, which I think is kind of telling.
Yeah.
He is
imprisoned. Oh, the Conan Doyle syndrome, yes.
He's imprisoned.
He may have gone over the Reichenbach Falls, but, you know, we didn't see the body, so.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that Charlie Hood has made it his life mission to be
Mike's keeper. Mike's keeper. Yeah, Charlie Hood is arguably insane at the end of book six, but he's happy. He has the job that he wants, which is imprisoning Mike Finnegan and protecting the world from Mike. And he also gets a job at the end of the book, the very last paragraph. He's hired to be police chief of Buena Vista, California, population 1,800, in the desert along the Mexican border.
Although it seemed like a great shame to waste a wine cellar on Mike Finnegan, but you know, what can you do?
I have to confess that when I read in the book that he was excavating his basement, I had a feeling that that's
did
where
you?
Yeah, I had a feeling that that's where he was going. Once again, did you intend that as you were writing the piece?
I knew that much for sure, because he's excavating at the end of the fifth book. He's watching the crane, you know, the backhoe dig out this thing that he's trying to convince his girlfriend is going to be a wine cellar. But we readers know that he's not going to put wine in there.
He's got a bigger game.
Right.
He's not particularly a wine drinker. He's got, what do they say, larger fish to fry.
The devil made him do it.
So I remember, I can't think of the year now. You'll know the year, but it must have been in the late 70s that my partner lawyer came to me and said, you know, you're a mystery fan. You might like this book. It's a book called Laguna Heat. Late 70s? Is that what it was?
1985.
Okay. So I was dazzled from the beginning. You know, and you've just gotten better and better, Jeff. I don't mean to sound like too much of a fan, but are you where you imagine? Are you where you imagined in your career? Are you where you wanted to be? I mean, this is obviously a change of direction now to write a standalone that's not a mystery.
Yeah.
Do you foresee more of those? I think you can do more of those.
Yeah, I'm working on another one right now. I'm working on a mystery too, though. So I mean, I'm going to be doing.
Oh, thank goodness.
I'm going to be writing a lot. I still have a lot of energy, and all I really have to do every day is write. You know.
Well, you know, kind of like Paul Simon said famously about Stevie Wonder. You know, those of us who write for the Edgars are appreciated that you're not writing a mystery this year. Paul Simon thanked Stevie Wonder for not releasing an album when he won his Grammy. You know, so. Three Edgars under your belt is a record that I think may not be broken for quite a while. So, but you have other stories to tell in other genre, I guess.
Yeah. The new book is full measure. It'll be out in September, and it's as I described it. It's a story about a young grunt coming back from the war. And as T.C. Boyle said, it's a story about the wars without and the wars within. And it's a look at America. It's a look at a family. It's a look at a young man who's trying to put really kind of a terrible past behind him. And I think that those young men and women who serve for us are, you know, really, really genuinely heroic and interesting. And I know a lot of them. I interviewed a lot of people. And so it was really nice to kind of do my own, I think very small, but still recognizable part in acknowledging what those guys have been through and learning a little bit about the war, this guy's war, and, you know, creating some fiction around them that goes beyond, you know, the crazy vet shooting things up. That's not what my book's about at all. It's about pursuing a dream, the American dream, and a 22-year-old guy trying to do it.
And the book after that, which you said, not the mystery, but the other standalone, is also having to do with returning veterans?
No, it's not. It's just I can't talk about it. It's top secret. I can't talk about that or the new thriller, but I'm working on two books now for the future.
Well, you can't talk about it unless you kill us.
Yeah.
Which is kind of tempting.
You, Nancy. I volunteer sorry, you. Yeah. So,
because I would at least die happy.
So you've been a regular at the festival over the years, Jeff. What, why? What's the festival mean to you as an author? And, you know, why?
It's great. I mean, you're an author. You're a writer. I spend 300 something days a year in the Bat Cave. Glued to the computer, writing these books, and I don't get out much, And so this is getting out. This is seeing who's reading me and who's liking my books and who's not. And I get to hang around with guys like Lee Goldberg and Bob Craze and Susan Strait, and people I just like, And it's really bitching to be able to come here and do it. I mean, what's not to like? It's wonderful. I wish they had one every other month.
We just came from lunch, and at lunch, I just was so touched by this that a young man sitting at our table said, "My sister's a writer. How does she get her book published?" And I didn't have a simple answer, but it was just exciting to talk about it. And I see that here all the time. Young readers, maybe even older readers, who want to know more about the magic of what happens. And of course, we know there isn't magic. It's hard work and all that. Unless we tell them where you get your ideas.
If I knew, I'd go right back to the same well. No, you're right. There's a neat, magic, if you will. Or a neat energy, especially in the young, or even in older people who are, embarking on writing their first book, maybe, or writing for the first time, and postpone that activity for a while. And when you run across a person who says something like that, how do I get published, and how do I write a good novel, or whatever, it's kind of cool. It's also cool to be able to address those questions somewhat. I'm no expert, and I have my own way of doing things, but I do know a little bit about, creativity and about the business end and stuff, and it's cool to be able to share a little bit with people if you can. There's no real secrets to that writing. Where do you get your ideas? I don't know.
Right. Well, this one, I gave an old school answer. I said, the traditional way is you try and get an agent excited about your book, and after that fails, then you can turn to self-publishing. Now that's all changing. And Lee, who you mentioned earlier, is a perfect example of that. He's a master entrepreneur. You haven't taken to self-publishing anything yet.
Not exactly. I have some back titles that are available electronically now that I own the rights to. So I guess I'm my own publisher.
Well, there you go.
Electronically, yeah. I am doing that, and it's really kind of cool. I get to pick out my own covers. I get to be the publisher. I can put whatever I want on the cover, and I'm in control of it. It's kind of neat.
Well, the newest trend, I think, a friend of mine was just writing about this, Laura Caldwell, was writing about self-publishing audio. She's a published author, but she kept audio rights, and now she's doing it herself. And your audios are brilliant. I mean, the audio books are fabulous. Have you had a hand in that? Have you gotten to pick the readers and things like that?
No. Brilliant Audio has been my audio publisher for over a decade. And they always choose the reader and, organize it how they want and stuff. And they always just do a wonderful job. So I could never read as good as those actors.
I don't remember who did this series, but the guy, his Mike Finnegan was really great.
David Colucci is his name. He's really good. Yeah.
I love them. So I tell people I'm reading their books, and I always mean audio because I'm in the car all the time. But it's been great to listen to them. So, well, we really appreciate your being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're here talking to other folks at the festival, and this will be up on our website soon. So,
thank you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you guys.
Look forward to the next book.
I first met Daryl James at a Men of Mystery event, which is held each November in Irvine, California. My husband Ed and I were seated at his table during the writer's lunch. His first novel, Nazareth Child, had just been published, and after the brief introduction he offered to the room at large and a more in-depth description to the diners at the table, I was hooked. Nazareth Child introduces us to Del Shannon, who tracks missing people. In this first tale, she's searching, well, essentially for herself. Along the way, in this deeply atmospheric novel, she, and along with her the reader, encounter all sorts of unsavory characters and situations, from cults and charismatic religious leaders to kidnapping and murder. But I'll let Daryl tell you more.
We're still at the Mystery Inc. bookstore booth at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, and I have with me Daryl James, who's got a series of three books out, the first of which was Nazareth Child, where he introduced Del Shannon, not the singer.
Not the singer, no.
Was there a reason you chose that name?
Well, I go through a lot of names, actually. When I start picking character names, I try out a few. And, you know, early on in the storytelling, if a name just doesn't fit, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like the character, I try on something else. And I came to the name Del Shannon, and it seemed to stick. You know, it was the one that stayed, and I couldn't change it now if I tried.
Well, and of course, in this case, Del is a woman.
That's right. She's a female investigator from Tucson who finds and recovers missing persons. So the entire series is based on her, each book being a quest that she goes on to return someone who's been gone missing for whatever nefarious reason.
When you do research for your novels, do you start with an actual story and build from there? I mean, Nazareth Child was one of the spookiest books I've ever read. I mean, it was...
Without being horror.
I mean, it was really dark. Religious fanaticism, murder. It was just that intersection of lots and lots of bad stuff.
Yeah.
Including a child that's been separated from her mother, and it's like so many of people's worst nightmares come together in one spot.
Yeah, the way I usually start a new book is I look for something that really fascinates me in some way, some idea, some theme or concept that just simply fascinates me completely. And I was always fascinated by the ideas of charismatics, these religious charismatics who can move many people to do things that to most of us are unreasonable and often very very dark. And so I was fascinated by that and had some early experiences growing. I grew up in Kentucky, so I had some early experiences with, you know, religious fanaticism.
Oh, that's okay.
And so that was the idea behind Nazareth Child. Other books, other themes. Book two was Sonora Crossing, and it involved a 7-year-old girl who was believed to be clairvoyant. She was believed to have prophetic visions. And I hit on the idea of this little girl who doesn't speak, but people believe that she has visions off into the future, and she can tell what's going to happen, some prophetic vision. And so I thought, that's a very fascinating idea to me, and so I based the story on it. That's how my stories get started.
Do you know pretty much where they're going to go when you start them, or is it just sort of a process?
I have no idea when I'm going. I start with that basic concept, that basic theme. And then I start writing, and things start to evolve. Characters start to come out of it. Sometimes those characters change along the way. But I start evolving and molding and creating the storyline that's going to fit around that basic theme that I've envisioned. And it just flows somewhat naturally, but unnaturally as well, because I scrap a lot of stuff along the way, change directions quite often.
Yes. And when we were speaking yesterday, you said you've started, you're publishing, self-publishing a novella as an ebook.
Well, it's not self-publishing, but it is being published by a publisher, but only as an ebook novella. It's a publisher that specializes in novella-length works, ebook only. And so I've signed a contract with the publisher for the first three in a series. It will be a separate series from my Del Shannon series, and the first one will be out in about 30 days, but it features a 70-year-old black man and his blind dog, and I've written a couple of stories with them, Little Earl and his blind dog, Melon, and they live on the streets of Westlake, and Earl takes photos under the name of Little Earl, and his photos hang in a gallery in Beverly Hills on consignment, and the gallery owner tells Earl, your photos look more like evidence than art, because he takes photos of the real, raw stuff on the streets of central L.A. And so it's in part, it's about his adventures with his dog, his blind dog. By the way, people think that he's blind and it's a seeing eye dog, but it's blind dog and seeing eye master.
A
little trick that I play on the audience while I'm writing it. But it gets you into the streets and Earl's this photographer. And sometimes his work gets him into trouble. Sometimes it gets him out of trouble. So each story will be a novella-length adventure of Earl and his blind dog.
Do you find it when you're constructing a novella versus a full novel, is the process similar? You start with a story and it's just going to be maybe not as many subplots or as many characters?
Yeah, usually, I come to this as a short storyteller. I've written over 40 short stories, so I seemingly have a knack for telling that short form in short stories. I've won a couple of awards for some of the stories I've written. And so I seemingly have this knack for writing the shorter works. But there's still full-length stories. Even my short stories unfold in a story arc that has a beginning and a middle and end, just like a novel would be. But I think you're right. Limited characters. Settings are usually closed in a little smaller overall from a novel.
Yeah.
And so for me, writing the novella, this was my first novella. It was really adapting some of my short story skills along with my novel skills and telling a story that unfolds over a medium period of time.
So it's a mashup. It's a stylistic mashup.
It is, in a way. And it gets you to that 35,000 words or so, more or less a half a novel. And there seemingly is a demand for that these days. Many of the major publishers are having their star writers writing novellas in between some of their.
Well, I know that Lee Child has done it, and T. Jefferson Parker was talking about doing it. So it's all. I mean, personally, I love short stories because it's to me it's like a snack.
Thank you very much.
You know, it's a lunchtime. You know, you can read one at lunchtime, and it's just a wonderful thing to do. Well, you know, as we've asked other writers, we're here at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, and. You know, it's a great event. What do you like about it? You've been here before, and
well, this is probably my ninth year. I'd have to go back and count the years, but I started out with some of my early short stories in anthology form, and coming to the LA Times Festival of Books. I've also been on organizations such as Sisters in Crime. I've been on the boards of those organizations, Mystery Writers of America, that are right behind us here, and so I've been involved with the LA Times Festival of Books. As one of the group board members supporting the organizations of Mystery Writers and Sisters in Crime. So I've worked the blues many times for years and years, as well as being an author along the way.
So, and do you find that you discover new writers that you might not have otherwise come across here?
On occasion, yes. And I think the readers that come here, the fans that come to the book festival, they come seeking new works and new authors and new things to read and new adventures to indulge in. And, you know, the greatest thrill for me as an author is someone who comes to the booth to find me, look for me intentionally because they read my book maybe 3 years ago, got it here at the LA Times Festival of Books, and then returned because they love that piece of work and want more. It's the greatest thrill I can imagine as an author.
So do we have another Del Shannon to look forward to?
There is another Del Shannon in the work. It's still in its early stages, so I won't tell you the plot behind it, but I think it's going to be a really unique plot idea that I've come to. And it won't be out this year, but possibly into the next year.
Well, thank you again, Daryl James, for coming and talking to us. It's been great, and I'm sorry I have to wait till 2015 for the next Del Shannon.
Well, we'll have plenty of stuff coming out in the meantime. Thank you, Natalie.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries. Check back next week for our interview with Joe Nesbø, the Norwegian mystery writing phenom. Until then, goodbye.